Welcome to Emmanuel. I hope that you saw the notice on the door and brought your brain with you. If not, I hope the coffee out there is strong. Feel free if you need to take a break this morning and walk out. If you start to wander, it might be my fault, but help me out by just going out, grabbing a cup of coffee, and coming back in. My name is Kyle. I'm the lead pastor here at Emmanuel, and I'm excited for the next 6 weeks as we explore this series called Don't Check Your Brain at the Door. This is a series that's designed for people of all walks of life. Whether you're actively a Christian and you have decided to follow Jesus, if you're a skeptic and go, I don't really think I can believe this stuff, and I have some big questions and doubts, or if you're somewhere in between, I'm hoping that over the next 6 weeks, some of your questions get answered. Even for those of us who have been Christians for a long time, sometimes we have questions that we feel don't get answered. And so I would encourage you, as Drew mentioned, those little cards, just feel free to write down questions and submit them. Or you can also email questions@emmanuelonline.ca. And please submit those by November the 6th, 19th, and then we'll try to answer as many as we can on the 26th. If you're not sure if your question's going to get answered, you can also look on that sheet. It gives you all the topics that we're going to be talking about. So this week, I wanted to start with the question, how can a reasonable person have faith? Our society often tells us that there's this huge gap, an uncrossable void between reason and faith. You don't have to go far to find it. Even just this week, when two giant neutron stars collided, scientists gathered together to say, what does this tell us about the universe? What does this tell us about whether or not a God could possibly exist? The BBC podcast called Stargazing talked about science and faith in the state of Hawaii. Just go to a college campus as well. It doesn't take long. You can walk into any department, whether it's a science department, a philosophy department. This debate is raging. How can a reasonable person have faith? And people on all sides of the university will all have different opinions. And it gets me thinking about the story of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson when they went camping. So Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, they went out and they did a day of hiking and they got up to this nice plateau and then they sat with their campfire under the stars until they got tired. Once they got tired, they headed to bed and they went to sleep. Partway through the night, Holmes got a little drafty and he woke up and he turns to Dr. Watson and says, "Are you awake?" Watson says, "Yes, what's up?" He says, "As you look out into the sky, what do you know?" Watson thinks for a moment. He says, "Well, astronomically, I can tell that there are billions of stars and tons of galaxies and that the universe is a vast place. Theologically, it makes me wonder, is there a God who makes us seem so insignificant? Meteorologically, as I look out, I think that tomorrow is going to have nice weather, and I can tell that it's probably 3:15. What about you, Holmes?" And Sherlock just stares at him blankly and says, "You idiot, our tent has been stolen." I tell that joke really just to point out that there's some necessity to face what's in front of us. When we come to this stuff, we have to engage with what's right before us before we can go deeper. So why even bother exploring faith or what God could be the real God if there's no rationale behind it, if there's no reason to even bother wasting our time trying to explore that question? I'm going to start up front and say that I am a follower of Jesus. I'm a Christian, and I believe in him and have centered my life around him, but that does not mean that I've thrown away my brain. Sometimes we think that Christians must have thrown away their brains to believe in something so silly, something that is obviously just a crutch for their brokenness, if they're willing to engage in this kind of silliness. But I think that there is a good, solid foundation with rational thinking to argue for having a faith in God. In fact, this is actually something that's woven into the Christian faith. If you turn to 1 Peter 3:15, you'll see it says, "But in your hearts revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect." I believe that through a variety of topics, whether it's science or philosophy or mathematics or ethics, we can actually create a rational case for a belief in God. We're going to go on further in this series and talk about which God or why the God that I have chosen to follow, that is Jesus. But for now, let's just open the door to, could there be a God? And as I study this, I think that we'll find that the two things go quite well hand in hand. The first place that we have to start, though, is this question of what is faith? Because faith goes by many definitions. We can use it to say different things. It could be specifically a faith in one God, or it could be a general religious system. But I want to define faith for this morning as trusting in something you cannot explicitly prove. Trusting in something that you cannot explicitly prove. This definition of faith is made up of two things. One is something called intellectual assent, and the other is called trust. Intellectual assent is essentially knowing the facts about something and trusting them to be true. That trust part is actually putting the trust in it. So if you took a chair, which you're all sitting in right now, the intellectual assent part is knowing that it's a chair, that it was designed by the way you look at it, you know that it's going to support your weight. The trust element is actually being willing to sit down in that chair. But I think because of this definition, we can see that everyone has faith in something. That we all have a bias towards different things. Each of our worldviews has been made up of our upbringing, the type of teaching we've had, the experiences that we've had in life. And all of these things create for us a system of beliefs. But not everything can be proven. Richard Dawkins, who's a famous atheist, and he's an Oxford professor, who's probably the most well-known atheist in the world, says that he's not sure of how the laws of physics came to be. He's not sure, in fact, what started the origins of the universe, but he knows for a fact that it was not God. At least he's pretty sure it wasn't. You see, even there, within it, there's a level of faith. And we shouldn't laugh at that because we all build into ourselves a level of faith that we don't often examine. And so it's very important for us to come back to this time and time again. But when we use that definition of faith, we all have it. And so it creates us on a common plane. Whether you're an atheist, someone who does not believe in God, or you're a theist, someone who does believe in God, we're equal at the starting ground. With all that in mind, I think that we can build the case using three areas: science, morals, and meaning. Science, morals, and meanings. Now, obviously, I only have about 30 minutes to go from here, and each one of these topics has tons of books dedicated and lectures and university seminars and all these types of things, so I'm only going to scratch the surface. And I also recognize that as we go through this, there's a lot of arguments that aren't fully developed here. And at the end of the service, we'll be putting up a slide that will have some additional resources. And I'd encourage you to go look at them and engage with this, because if we're going to truly hold up to that thing that we should have a defense for our faith, we owe it to ourselves to learn more and dig deeper into this. But let's begin with science. Whenever reason versus faith comes up, science always comes in. You can't listen to a single debate or people talk about this in any department of a university without coming back to science. A gentleman named John Lennox, who's a mathematician and a philosopher of science at the University of Oxford, says that science cannot disprove God, but it can point to God. Science can't disprove God, but it can point to God. Now, lots of people right off the bat, right there and then said, but wait, it can. Science can disprove God, they'll say, but if you think that, you're wrong. It's just a matter of fact, because science deals with the natural world. Science deals with tangible things that we can touch and study and feel. But the study of God is a metaphysical study, which means that it's outside the existence of physics and the natural laws. So the two cannot disprove one or the other. You can't take science and say, no, God doesn't exist because I can't test him. Well, we're saying that he's actually a metaphysical being. He's something that exists outside of science. But you could argue, perhaps, that the odds are very unlikely that a God exists, or that the odds are that a God exists. Even Richard Dawkins, that author and atheist who wrote the book The God Myth, says you cannot disprove God through science. But he believes that there is almost certainly no God. He says this because the math doesn't add up in his mind. Which is interesting, because if slim odds are what makes it us able to rule out God, I'd like to share with you something called the Anthropic Principle. The Anthropic Principle is something that gives us insight into how finely tuned our universe is. The Anthropic Principle is a fairly straightforward philosophical idea. It basically says that the observations that we make about the universe around us must be compatible with us to observe. So we can see them, because if they didn't exist, we wouldn't be existing ourselves. A guy named Douglas Adams explains it this way. He uses a picture of a puddle. He says, imagine a puddle waking up one morning and thinking to itself, this is an interesting world I find myself in. It's an interesting hole I find myself in. It fits me rather well, doesn't it? In fact, it fits me so well that this hole must have been made to have me in it. When you look at the world around us, it is amazingly fine-tuned. The scientists have studied that there's somewhere between 50 and 30 universal constants, which different departments would say make up why the universe exists and lasts in the way that it does. And if you changed any one of them, even slightly, that the universe would cease to exist or at least become uninhabitable for human beings. Take, for instance, the force that holds protons and neutrons together. If you made this force 2% stronger, hydrogen would not exist. Water has hydrogen in it. No more water, no more people. When you look at the planets within our solar system, you see that if you took Jupiter, Mars, Saturn, or Neptune, and you moved them even a degree outside of their orbital pattern, it would change everything gravitationally for us, and poof, humans would all die on planet Earth. If you look at our sun, there's light waves that come out of it, and if you changed the sun's color at all, if you made it slightly more blue or slightly more red, plants could no longer photosynthesize the light, and poof, we're all dead. One of the constants that exists in the world is the constant of mass and energy. And they studied the odds of this and said, okay, for the principles of mass and energy to exist in our world and to expand at the beginning of the universe, the odds are 1 to the power of 10 to the power of 123. I'm not very good at math, so I had to look up what that is. And the problem is, as you look on the internet, you actually cannot find this number fully written out. Because if you were to write this number down, you would have to put a 1, and then if you wrote a 0 on every single particle in the universe, we don't have enough particles to write down all the zeros. Those aren't very good odds, are they? So this makes me think that it's finely tuned. And in fact, Stephen Hawking even said, the remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers, these universal constants, seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. I'm certainly not a mathematician, but with those odds, it seems much more rational to me that if we are so finely tuned for life on this planet, then it makes sense that there would be something that finely tuned our universe. The next area of science is biology, specifically the study of DNA. DNA is incredibly complex. DNA is made up of 4 chemicals, which look like a code that it dictates the action of every cell in our body. The code is made up of, every strand has 3 billion letters within it. That means if you were to take this code and you were to read the letters at a rate of 3 letters per second, it would take you 31 years of reading it nonstop at the rate of 3 letters per second to read one strand of DNA. And that's within every single cell of our body. This guy, Dr. Francis Collins, who was the director of the Human Genome Project, which was the project to map out DNA and to study it. So basically, he's the guy who knows more about DNA than anyone else in the world, described DNA this way. He said, think of DNA as an instructional script, a software program of sorts, sitting in the nucleus of the cell. What's amazing is that every software program that has ever been written needs a very complex mind behind it to drive it. People who are in the tech industry actually know that usually the first iterations of software that come out on the market are going to have problems. Many will actually avoid when the new Windows or the new Mac software comes out because they know that there's going to be bugs within it that have problems, or they've come to accept it because code is incredibly complex. But they know, in fact, that the human DNA is even far more complex than any computer software that we have. And this is exactly the reason why the former prominent atheist, Dr. Anthony Flew, changed his mind. He was so amazed at the study of DNA because he said, superintelligence is the only good explanation for the origin of life and the complexity of nature. Now, I know I've started quoting a handful of scientists and professors, and some of these people believe that faith and science go together, and others do not. So how many of these academics, these scientists and philosophers, actually believe in this stuff? Well, we used to think back in the 50s and 60s that the more we learned about science, the further away we would get from God. We would start to simply prove that God could not be because he doesn't line up with science. And so in the 60s, we saw this all-time low of professors in universities that would say, yes, I believe there could possibly be a God. But in the 70s, this guy, Dr. Alvin Plantinga, threw out a list of arguments for why there could be rational existence of God, why science could back it up. And suddenly, professors, as they started to go through this, started to see that for the first time, maybe there really is a good argument. Maybe there is some good rationale why we think God could possibly exist. And this has been quite a frustrating thing for a number of people. There's a guy named Quentin Smith, who's a philosophy professor, and he says that today perhaps 1/4 or 1/3 of philosophy professors are theists, with most being Orthodox Christians. He goes on to say that God is not dead in academia. Now, that number doesn't seem like an incredible amount, 25% or 33%, but when you think that not long ago, that number was closer to 10%, we've seen quite a shift. And Smith actually says that he does not like the way the trend is going. It's going in the opposite direction from his hope, that would be that we would get Christians out of universities. But he can't help but admit that there are rational arguments for the existence of God. The beauty of science is that it points us to a God through the observation of the worlds around us. Did you know that the modern scientific revolution actually took place because of Christianity? When you look back and they've studied, and historians have studied science and how it developed, they've looked back at the Greeks and the Romans and the Chinese, and they've said, yes, all of these groups had different pockets of science. We can go back to ancient Egypt and see it, and ancient Babylonia and see it, but never was there a case where it exploded onto the scene as something that caught traction amongst regular people. And so they've studied and actually went back and said, but there's a reason why it exists within Christianity, because within Christianity, there's an argument for why to do it. So not just in 1 Peter 3:15, where it says, give a reason for why you have faith, But in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, it said, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse." Whether or not you agree that Scripture can be trusted, those people did. The people in medieval times who were interested in science looked and said, there's a reason that I need to defend my faith. And there's also a reason that I need to explore it, because I believe that creation, the world around me, tells me something about God. So we need to study it. And that's why today, still the most recognizable universities that study in philosophy and science, almost all of them were at one point a seminary. Whether you look at Oxford or Cambridge or Yale or Harvard or many others, they started as Christian institutions with the purpose of exploring and finding out who God is through his creation and the world around the people who founded those schools. There's a lot more to science, but we're going to move on for a moment to morality. The connection between rational thinking and morals is one of those places that gets quite contentious. Sometimes people end up thinking that we're challenging one another's morals and the way we live, what we view as right and wrong. But if we just boil it down to the basic principles, there's sort of two areas of thought. There's something called subjective morality and something called objective morality. Subjective moralities are when humans get to create the moral code they live by. And objective morality means that, no, there's a universal one. So subjective morality, an individual gets to say, I think this is right or wrong. Objective morality says, no, there just is right or wrong. And both arguments actually have some good value to them. But I think the question is, most importantly, does subjective morality even exist? When you dig down into somebody and start picking at this, do they genuinely believe it? Ravi Zacharias answers this question with an illustration. He says, a number of years ago, a woman who had been given birth through C-section found out to her horror that something had gone wrong. As the doctors had gone to take the baby out, they'd inflicted deep wounds on the baby's face so that the baby could not breathe and breastfeed. The doctor said, no, it's okay, the baby will heal, the wounds look good. And so they packed up the mother and baby after a few days and sent them home. Things didn't get better. So the mother comes back and she shows up at the hospital and says, you need to help. And they go, I'm sorry, who are you? Turns out that the hospital staff had expunged all the records of this woman and her child ever having been there. And they said, you know what? If you come back here, we are going to call the police and have them come after you for the things that you have done to your baby. Now, whether or not that story is true, I don't know if there's a healthy person who can hear that story who does not get disgusted. I think woven within every single person, there is a deep desire for justice to come. Injustice is not satisfied in any culture. So doesn't that lead us to think that perhaps there's a moral code that goes beyond culture or individuals? I like the way C.S. Lewis puts it. He says, there is real right and wrong. People may sometimes be mistaken about them, just as people get their sums wrong, but they are not a matter of mere taste and opinion any more than the multiplication table. Now, some atheists would argue that objective right and wrong does exist. They say, absolutely, but you know what? Our morality is simply a byproduct of evolution. As the world has gone and as all people have evolved, we've all started with us this moral code that helps us live in existence. The problem with this viewpoint, however, is that our morals are sometimes in conflict with the principle of survival of the fittest. Take, for instance, Mother Teresa, Corrie ten Boom, William Wilberforce. Take into account the police officers and firefighters that we see every day. These people are willing to sacrifice and put their life on the line. And you know what? Those don't increase your chances of propagating your DNA. They don't increase the likelihood that you are going to have more kids who are like you, who are going to survive better than any other human being that has come before. No, those people would say that there's something woven within them that is driving them forward, something that compels them to sacrifice. It makes sense to me then that there must be someone or something that has given this moral code, for the fact that it would be irrational to say if there is no God, then moral values are just the products of socio-biological evolution, because we prove it wrong all the time. If there is a God, though, a God who actually genuinely cares about people, I think it makes sense of what we see in the people around us. I think it gives an explanation to all those people, those few examples and many more through history, who have been willing to sacrifice and risk their own lives for others. Those two views, I think, are compatible. Then my last argument, which will hopefully show you that faith in God can at least make a little bit of sense, that you could at least be open to it, is in a topic called cosmogony. Cosmogony has to do with the theories of the origin of the universe. As we study the universe, we've actually got to see that it is expanding. They first saw this firsthand and knew it to be true with the Hubble Space Telescope. And as they've started to see and dig into this more and more, they've actually said, wow, the universe is expanding way faster than we thought it did. So they take the expansion rate of the universe and apply that with the second law of thermodynamics. You can look it up. I'm not going to explain it. But those two things together basically tell us that the universe is not eternal. The universe has a birthday. Most of us in this room have some type of documentation of the lives we've lived, whether it's through photographs that our parents took or we've taken, whether it's through videotapes that we can go back and watch. We can go back and look at our whole life. But imagine we could do that with the universe. Imagine if we rewound the tape to the very first day. Well, we could go back and we could start with us, and we rewind a little bit to a few minutes ago when we were singing. Then we rewind to when our alarm went off. Then we can even rewind to when we were born, or perhaps even that romantic evening of your conception. Then we rewind back a little bit further and we go to your grandparents or your great-grandparents. And then suddenly we're back in the Dark Ages. We keep going back, and at some point the tape runs out. The moment the universe came to exist, scientists get stuck here. Scientists get stuck, whether they're Christian or non-Christian, as to what was the exact moment. What happened? What drove this? And scientists have come further and further as they've used the Higgs boson particle accelerator and those types of things. But we believe that something causes everything. That's rational. I want you to close your eyes for a minute. Nothing happened. It doesn't make sense, does it? We all believe that something was caused from something. Even the sound of a clashing cymbal in the back of the room to the beginning of the universe. But there's a limit to science. There's a limit to the science that we have right now, especially saying we can't know. Ian Hutchinson, who's a plasma physicist who works at MIT, he's the guy who takes nuclear reactors and tries to produce the same power that stars produce. He sits there and he goes, science and faith do overlap, but I think it's important for us to recognize that science has limits. There are many things that natural science is incompetent to study because its methods rely on reproducibility and clarity, which are properties that not all subjects possess. This guy is the king of and clarity within science. He has to be precise, or the lives of many around him are at risk. And he says this, because when we look at matter, the dark matter that is expanding to see our universe still going out, the matter that makes up each and every one of us, matter doesn't just come from matter, it had to come from somewhere. So for everything to come into existence at one point, there has to be a point before matter started. This is where we get hung up. So it's in my estimation that for all the matter that exists in the universe, at some point, there was something that wasn't matter that created it. Let's call that God. So it seems rational to me that if anything exists, because we believe that everything comes from nothing, everything comes from something, there must be a God or a force somewhere. The question then is, how does this give meaning to the universe? That same guy, Ian Hutchinson, went on to say, he said, followers of Jesus believe that both the deepest reality and the highest moral meaning of authority are to be found in loving relationship. We believe that the universe exists because a God whose nature is love, expressed in relationship, has willed it to be so. That basically boiled down says, we believe that the reason that the universe exists and that it is the way it is because there's a God who chose for it to exist and to be the way that it is. Now, let's not be naive. There's tons of counter-arguments to every single one of the arguments that I've put forward so far this morning. There's reasonable cases for people not to believe. The question is, what is more reasonable? And this comes down to something that I think goes beyond just a rational belief, but goes to a point of an experiential belief. Philosophers believe in this. They've given this term the topic of properly basic belief. So what's a properly basic belief? It's ultimately that our senses and our experiences tell us something. We actually can rely on them. Because if I ask you, do you live in the Matrix? Or if you're a Black Mirror fan, how do you know that you're not a consciousness that has been taken and copied from someone and put into some type of machine or body to live out an existence? How do you know you're not just a brain in a vat of goo that some scientist somewhere is stimulating, making you think that you're sitting in church here this morning? Well, we can't prove that we're not. Except for the fact that our senses and our experiences tell us that we are, in fact, who we are, where we are, when we are. The question is why we are. So our Christian belief is actually founded in part on this properly basic belief that we can experience a God, and that can point to us to know that He exists. I know for some people this crosses over from rational to irrational. This leaps over and you go, I can throw this out, but I genuinely believe in it. I believe that if you full-heartedly want to experience God, that you can and you will. In the Bible, in the book of James, chapter 4, verse 8, it says, draw near to God, and He will draw near to you. I think anyone who is genuinely searching for the answer, who is genuinely pondering the question, is there a God? Who is willing to check and try, willing to see if they can experience Him, will. And I think it will convince them. If you're here this morning and you have questions about that, I'd encourage you after the service to come and talk with me. And I'd love to go into these arguments more carefully and have a conversation about that. But moreover, I'd really like to have an opportunity to look at you and say, here's how you might be able to experience who God is. For those of us who are already followers of Jesus, my hope is that this morning gave you some food for thought, that it helped you maybe even hear or rehear some of these principles that you can start to explore further to give you a rational foundation for why you believe what you believe. And my hope that at the end of this, at some point, someone's going to come up to you and say, so why do you have that hope? Why Jesus? And you have some answers to give them. Let's pray.